Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 174, and it's packed with incident. First off, a big thank you to all the folks who have supported me and for sharing so many personal stories of your ancestry, particularly Jane, who's a font of knowledge about the Williams family, and John, who's been communicating about the transcribe. When we left off episode 173, King Mswati I was running out of patience with his elder brother, Somtkua. Voortrekker leader Hendrik Potgieter had also left the area north of the Swazi territory, settling in the Soutpansberg. That was his last trek. He'd signed a treaty with Bapedi chief Sekwati before he left, which had precluded any proper agreement with the other Voortrekkers around Lydenburg. With Potgieter gone, though, things were going to change. The final stages of the internal Swazi dispute began on August 1849 when Somtkuba began spreading rumours amongst the trekkers at Urgstad that a force of Mswati's warriors were on its way to attack the lager of Veldkornet de Beer. That was not true, but Somtkuba wanted some sort of insurance because he now believed Mswati was going to attack him. There is some argument about whether or not Mswati had decided to do this, but either way, Somtkuba's position was tenuous, to say the least. The attempt at fostering suspicion and ill will against Mswati appeared to be working, and Somtkuba followed up his whispering campaign in September 1849 when he claimed that the Swazi king had dispatched another set of warriors to join up with Gaza chief Soshangani in order to attack the Boers. The Voortrekkers were very wary about Soshangani Kagasa Zikodi, who'd been born Soshangani Ka Umalo. He was the father of the extensive Gaza Empire, which, at the heart of its power, stretched from the Limpopo River in southern Mozambique all the way to the Zambezi in the north. I covered Soshangani in some detail in episode 171, and if you remember, he had succeeded in dominating Mozambique and extracting tribute from the Portuguese settlements at Delagoa Bay and Sofala, and from the Portuguese forts and the Prazos on the Zambezi itself. Beyond the core of his kingdom on the Sabi River, his power depended on the presence of his regiments, which could not be everywhere at once. The term Shangan, which properly relates to the conquerors themselves, include all of these who were conquered too. They contributed manpower to the Gaza army, and the Ndawo lost a high proportion of their men in this way. So Somtkuba was playing fast and loose with the facts, hiking the fears in order to protect himself from Mswati. By December of 1849, the relationship between Somtkuba and Mswati had deteriorated to such an extent that they dragged the Boers into their internecine conflict. The Landrost all the way west at Krugersdorp was being sent messages by both chiefs accusing the other of stoking violence. Mswati finally sent his army to deal with Somtkuba. There was a clash at the Nkomati River. Somtkuba was defeated, and he fled to live with the Boers for the next 5 years. By now, Mswati had figured out that the Boers were not going to be neutral observers in his clashes with other members of his royal family. The Swazi king sent messengers to Durban to ask the British Lieutenant Governor to rein in the AmaZulu. As you heard last episode, Mpande was now using the Swazi clashes to try and seize territory from the AmaSwazi, and Mswati wanted the English to pressurize the Boers about the support of Somtkuba. Southern African history is replete with a sort of to and fro. It's part of the political landscape. Mswati had other problems. Two other brothers were also testing his leadership, the AmaKhanzambili chieftains. The royal lines were chafing under this young king's rule. Mpande had already raided Mswati's territory in 1848, but the scale of the invasion had been small, and the AmaZulu warriors had retreated after failing to defeat Mswati. But he knew they'd be back. It was a matter of when, not if. For the next iteration of the AmaSwazi-AmaZulu clashes, we must wait a few episodes, because that would take place in 1852. First, we need to swing back across the vast land to the region south of the Vaal River, because dramatic events were taking place in 1848, clashes between the British Empire and the Trekkers. By now, the area between the Orange and the Vaal was an imbroglio. Elements of every type of society that existed in southern Africa for millennia could be found scattered across this region. Hunters and gatherers, pastoralists, farmers, San, Khoisan, Khoikhoi, Basutu, Afrikaners, Boers, mixed race, Griqua, Kurana, and even British settlers could be found here. In some cases, different combinations of these people live together cheek by jowl, many in combinations of cultures and languages and political systems. A classic frontier situation with intermingling and very little structured relationship characterizing the mingling. Some of the San, Khoikhoi, and even Basutu were now incorporated as servants of the Boers, and each of those groups were divided into rival political communities. Bands of San still hunted through this area, despite attempts to eradicate them, a kind of ethnic cleansing you've heard about. In the southeast, on either side of the Caledon River, rival Sotho states existed under Moshoeshoe, Moletsane, Sikonyela, and Moroka. Each of these had their own tame missionaries living alongside as a kind of insurance policy against each other and the British and the Boers. Southwest were the Kora and the Griqua, predominantly Khoikhoi in origin, but through the two centuries of interaction with the Dutch, had become infused with Caucasian DNA and influenced by Trek Boer culture. They were generally regarded as hunters and gatherers. Some were pastoralists, others cultivators of small fields. Most were now feared as gun-carrying predators by the Basutu. And by 1848, the new governor of the Cape, Sir Harry Smith, had begun to experiment with British expansionism that he'd observed in India. Assuming British culture and traditions, the empire's institutions were superior to all other. Smith loved to oversimplify complex problems, and that made him a natural expansionist and a man likely to make big mistakes. Within 2 months of arriving in Cape Town in December 1847, he had extended the frontiers of the Cape Colony to the Orange River in the arid northwest of the Cape. This was between the area known as Rama and the Atlantic Ocean. He had annexed the land between the Kaiskamma River and the Kraai River basin in the east, booted out the Amaxhosa, and annexed two contiguous areas as separate British colonies, British Kaffraria between the Kaiskamma and the Kai River, and a second area that became known as the Orange River Sovereignty between the Orange and Vaal Rivers. More about that in a minute. Back in England, Colonial Secretary Earl Grey accepted what was ostensibly Smith's fait accompli with reluctance. He had been told by Smith that the cost of managing all this new land would be met, yes, by local tax. Now, as most of us know, there are only two certain things in life, death and tax. But the frontier spirit of the time railed against the idea of coughing up cash for Smith's vision of a British empire straddling the Orange and Kaiskamma rivers. The majority of settlers, although appreciating Smith's military prowess, were totally against the idea of paying his tax. The Orange River sovereignty in particular was case in point. Even up to 1872, its revenue was never going to exceed £12,000 a year and derived largely from hunting licenses. And of course, animals were going to disappear. And taxing of local Boer and English farmers, a land tax. There was no grant in aid, as it was called, from the British Empire itself. The public service in this huge expanse was restricted to the resident magistrate, Major Henry Warden. There were four other magistrates in charge of each district, five clerks who totted up the numbers, eight constables to keep the peace, one Dutch reformed minister, and four schoolmasters. All of these technocrats were regarded with suspicion by the people of the Orange River sovereignty, and most were deficient in training and ability, according to various sources. Don't take my word for it. Those critical of these handful of officials include historian De Kiewit in his work British Colonial Policy and the South African Republics, not to mention a few damning paragraphs in the autobiography of Harry Smith himself and historian Van Jaarsveld's book Eenheidsstrewe and B.J. Barnard's musings in the biography A Levensbeschrijving van Majoor Henry Douglas Warden. You can't really blame Smith. One of the reasons for his rushed decision on the Orange River sovereignty was the response from the Trek Boers, and one in particular, that was Andries Pretorius, the highly experienced Voortrekker leader. So it was in January 1848 that Governor-General and Commander-in-Chief Sir Harry Smith rode into the region on the border between Natal and the Orange Free State with the intention of settling various challenges with the Trekkers directly. There's a bit of debate about what happened. Perhaps it was those pesky translators messing about again, but Pretorius was made to understand that the British would not annex the half-veld territory until Boers had been consulted. Only after the Falks' decision would Pretorius report back to Smith about their view of his annexation. Relations between these two were icy, to put it mildly. If you recall, the British and the Boers had already had a skirmish in 1846 where Major Warden had dispersed a force of trekkers after clashes with the Griqua in the southwest of the Orange Free State. After this, Warden had been appointed as British resident of the Free State and had been stationed at Bloemfontein with a handful of troops. Then suddenly, on the 3rd of February 1848, Smith annexed the Orange River Territory, and an indignant Pretorius immediately embarked on a tour of the Hafeld Boer settlements from Winberg to the Soutpansberg to stir up opposition. Smith, on the other hand, headed back to Cape Town, happy in the knowledge that he'd extended the British Empire further into southern Africa. Pretorius was so incensed that he began fanning the flames of anti-British opposition, or probably, to be a bit more accurate, anti-Smith opposition. He put out feelers to Moshoeshoe, the Portuguese governor at Delagoa Bay, and even Mpande of the AmaZulu. None of the African chiefs would have anything to do with him, neither would the Portuguese governor. The bitter resentment at Smith's unilateral action amongst the trekkers grew, and Warden was now in a particularly exposed position with his total force of 8 constables facing the angry Boers of the Free State and the Transvaal. The resentment boiled over in July 1848, when Pretorius, with Commandants Stander, Kok and Mok, led a powerful force of 200 Transvaalers and about 800 Free Staters, along with a 3-pounder artillery gun, into Bloemfontein. On the 20th of July, Warden was given terms: surrender or face the consequences. To fight against a force of around 1,000 men on horses with his paltry force of 8 would have been suicidal, even for a man steeped in the honour code of the British Army, and he capitulated and agreed to leave. But Warden had seen what was coming. A week earlier, on the 13th of July, Warden had sent an urgent message to Smith from Bloemfontein, which arrived in Cape Town on the 22nd of July, remarkably quickly, if you consider the distance. Smith ordered all troops in Grahamstown and adjoining districts to mobilize and march to Colesberg. As I've said previously, that little town on the main highway between the Highvelds and Cape Town is probably one of the most strategic in South Africa. These days, it's a place where the SA Police Service love to stage massive roadblocks for the same reason. Back to our tale. Colesberg lies about 400 kilometers north of Grahamstown, so the British infantry marching towards Bloemfontein gave the Boers some time to organize themselves. On the 29th of July, Smith and his staff left Cape Town and rode directly to Colesberg, arriving there in a truly impressive 11 and a half days, cantering in on the 9th of August. The measured route in 1848 was 615 miles, or 989 kilometers. They say that Smith was a man of action. His riding skills were legendary, but even for the time, this was pushing the envelope. From Colesberg, Smith led an army of 600 men with 3 6-pounder cannon to the Orange River, where they crossed at Boetersdrift on the 26th of August. It was midwinter, and the veld was brown, the mornings freezing, the days clear and hot. Smith was not alone. He was travelling with a few dozen Boers who had flipped sides, fighting for the British, as well as 4 companies of the Cape Mounted Rifles. The English were travelling heavy, the oxen dragging 150 wagons containing ammunition, 30 days of food, and the usual extravagances of the officer corps, silverware and bottles of wine. The Boers had decided to try and fight the English as soon as they crossed into the Free State, but Pretorius surveyed the area near Boetersdrift and found there was no fodder available for his horses. So he moved his men north of Philippolis to a farm called Telpoort and established his lager there. Smith arrived in Philippolis on the 27th of August and continued moving rapidly towards Bloemfontein. The next day was a place called Fisser's Hook, about 120 kilometers southwest of Bloem. Adam Kok and 250 of his Griqua men now joined the British, adding a significant amount of firepower and mobility to the British units. The weather was logged as fine and dry, a typical winter's day in southern Africa. The Boers knew this country well, but now they faced an army led by a commander who had quite a bit of experience of fighting in southern Africa. Smith was aware that between him and Bloemfontein there was only one place where the Boers could put up a fight, and that was the range of hills in an area known as Boomplatz, the place of trees. Before dawn on the 29th of August, patrols brought the news that they had located the Boer position, based at Boomplatz as forecast. Pretorius's men had also been wrecking the British position on the night of the 28th, so both sides knew exactly where the other was. The only mystery was exactly how many men the Boers had managed to mobilize. Pretorius had decided that Boomplatz did give him the best chance of victory, even though it was an obvious spot. One of the most important principles of warfare is surprise, and Pretorius was laying a trap for the English. He had over 700 men waiting in the kopjes alongside a sinuous spruit called Krommelenboog, or Crooked Elbow. If you look at a map of Boomplatz Hill and the river nearby, it's indeed a crooked elbow. Very difficult landscape for any attacking force. A small road led down into the Krommelenboog, and a shallow drift was the crossing. Just north of this was a Boer homestead, above that their cattle kraal. About 2 kilometers south of the crossing is a range of low hills, humps really, that cross the road, a kind of blind rise just before the drift. To the west, or to the left of Smith's men as they approached along this road, was a hill about 0.5 kilometer away. Excellent spot for a bit of sharp shooting. To the east, Smith's right, 2 low hillocks ran parallel to the road about 50 meters away. An even better spot for a bit of heavy fire. About 200 meters north of the drift, the road crossed a range of hills which lie quite close to the stream. Pretorius had eyed this part of the landscape with a great deal of interest because 2 flanking hills overlooked the road. What a perfect place for an ambush, he thought. The road passed extremely close to the 2 hills, which were low-lying humps, really, but an excellent place for his men to lie in wait, the humps giving cover to his men's horses behind. By the way, I managed to find the original British Army report into this battle, which is in the Journal of the Society for Army Historical Research, published in 1937. I'll load the map of the battle site into my blog for reference purposes, just in case there's any confusion about all this East and West stuff. Just head on to desmondlatham.blog. You'll find the Boomplatz update front and center. The problem for the Boers was there was only one way to escape. To the northwest, the Krommelenboog River curves away and has cut a very deep pool that is nearly 2 kilometers long. There was no escape across that part of the river. Close to the drift crossing along the road, there were multiple points for horsemen to leave, but below the drift, the rocky river would make for a very difficult gallop. So they'd have to withdraw along the road to the north themselves. As Smith approached this area, he saw the kopje opposite the crossing, about 200 meters wide, about 400 meters long. One of those typical Free State kopjes you'll find in this area. And the cattle kraal was based on the northeast face, just above the farm buildings, to his right, in other words. Another ideal spot for the Boers to lie in wait, which is exactly what sections of them were doing. About 1.5 kilometers further on, just around this kopje, was the Boer gun, placed on a larger hill and clearly visible. If the British made it round the little kopje with its cattle kraal, it could open fire on their advance parties. What Pretorius hoped was that Smith would spot the gun and see the few men there and presume that the entire Boer force was on the hill and not lying in wait much closer. Pretorius had set up his main force in the 2 hills alongside the road, just before the drift. An army crossing a river is in an exposed position, and Pretorius was playing a double bluff. But Smith, for all his faults, was no fool when it came to military tactics. The main force of Transvaalers under Pretorius lay in the centre of these hills on the left, with the Free State Boers on both sides. Cook and 100 men were further west. They had come into play when the British tried to cross the drift, if they made it that far. Commandant Stunder and 200 men lay in wait east of the road, creating a killing field, an arc of death. It was unfortunate for Stunder, who would give the game away, if you don't mind the pun, because as his men rode to their positions at 11 a.m., they disturbed a herd of wildebeest watering at the large pool I mentioned. These streamed across the front of the Boers' main position at exactly the moment that the British advance guard of Cape Mounted Rifles approached. Their commander, Lieutenant Warren, and a few of his men galloped to the top of the little hill near the road and spotted the Boers. Smith didn't hesitate. He ordered the rest of the Cape Mounted Rifles to charge ahead and rode with him, always up for a fight, which is exactly what he got. He'd been hoping for some kind of final peace talk before he pitched up to Boomplatz, but the Boers were in no mood to chit-chat. Just as this group of riders crested the second hillock, the crowd of Boers opened fire on the advancing British. One of the English officers was killed, along with 2 other men. Smith was hit, but luckily for him, the musket ball cut his stirrup leather and just bruised his leg. The main Boer position on the western side of the road opened fire as well. The British wagons shuddered to a halt, and Smith returned to the centre of his force to figure out what to do next. A few hundred men of the Cape Mounted Rifles were joined by what Smith called his loyal Boers and the Griqua, and this force thundered off to the left straight towards Pretorius's main force lying behind these small hills. Commandant Cook then spotted the wagons and ordered his men to launch their own attack on the exposed machines, these 150 vehicles stretching back 4 kilometers to the south. But the Cape mounted rifles were ready and took up positions to slow him down. Then the British cannon opened fire, and Cork's attack ran out of steam. By now he had lost about half a dozen men in the barrage and the firefight. He withdrew, leaving Pretorius to fight off the British near the drift. The Cape mounted rifle commanders, particularly Lieutenant Warren, realized that the critical point of the battle had been reached, and, along with 2 rifle brigades, managed to clear Pretorius from the ridge. The Boers were in a rough spot because the British forces had moved so fast. Many couldn't get to their horses behind the hill. The Boers now ran over the broken ground towards the large pool of water on the Krommelenburg River. The rest also broke and ran, heading towards the drift, which was the easiest place to cross. Pretorius managed to rally his men in the bed of the Spruit below the drift, but Smith was not to be denied, and moved a large section of his men to the hill overlooking this position, while the rest of the Boers tried to provide some covering fire for Pretorius from the kraal and the farmhouse across the river. At 12:45, the Boers were in full retreat, running up the road to the north towards their gun position. The only cannon was knocked out shortly after this. The Boers managed to rally at a few more places as they withdrew, slowing the Griqua and the Cape Mounted Rifles down and buying themselves time. They had run out of ammunition, and by 2 p.m. things were done. The Boers had been defeated. They rushed to their wagons at the laager 20 kilometers north, then withdrew to Sunna's post. From there, Pretorius ordered his men to disperse back to their farms. The next day, the 30th of August 1848, Sir Harry Smith marched to Telpoort and entered Bloemfontein finally on the 2nd of September 1848. He was a happy man. His infantry and mounted units had worked in perfect harmony with his 3 6-pounder guns. They had managed to defeat Pretorius's veteran frontiersmen in less than a day of fighting. Smith had initially thought the Free State campaign against the Boers was going to be bloody and lengthy, but it was over virtually as it started. The British lost 2 officers, 10 wounded, 14 other soldiers were killed, 32 wounded. The Boers reported they lost 9 dead and 5 wounded, although it's likely they lost far more, possibly as many as 49 men. And so ended the first of 3 clashes between the British and the people who would become known as the South African Republicans. 33 years were going to elapse before the next trial of strength between these 2 opponents. This Battle of Boomplatz is not well known. It was a major victory for the British, and for the Boers it was a warning about how not to fight against an empire. Pretorius had been stung. The first Boer War would break out in 1880, and in that war the Boers were going to teach the British a lesson in military tactics. But that's for episodes far in the future. Next episode, we'll circle back south to the Cape Colony. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate the visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to load an update about this episode. You can email me from there. Until next, goodbye.